I say do it. That's my advice. Whenever I hear people say, oh, I want to do this, like when my kids finish school, I'm like, no, the time for you to do this is when your kids are in school. There are just so many to me, like to benefits. Like, so as a single parent, having the ability to afford someone else to come in the house to help me release me to be a better parent.
I'm Felina Jean, and this is Black Broads Abroad. I'm an international woman of leisure who said peace out to the United States in 2011, and I have not looked back except at this ass, honey. Since then, I've lived on four continents but traveled to over 40 countries. Along my journey, I've come to know some very compelling Black women from all over the world who also said fuck you to their comfort zones. I created this podcast to inspire Black women in the diaspora to take risks and live their very best lives.
Truth Smith currently works at the International School of Tanzania as a secondary learning support teacher, located in the coastal Tanzanian city of Dar es Salaam. Originally from Fort Washington, Maryland, a suburb of Washington, D.C., she previously taught at Western Academy of Beijing in Beijing, China, Discovery College in Hong Kong, and various public schools in her home state. Before transitioning into education, Truth worked for many years as an attorney for a nonprofit legal service organization. She has a BA in sociology from Spelman College, a JD from the University of Maryland School of Law, and an MA in leadership and teaching in special education from Notre Dame of Maryland University. The daughter of two former educators and the parent of two young adults that were raised both in the United States and abroad, Truth joins us for our interview today. Welcome, Truth.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking this time to talk to me today. I'm gonna give like a little bit of backstory about how we even came into each other's orbit. I think it was like, it was 2013 or 20, I think it was 2014, January of 2014. I was living in Korea at the time, and I had to come to Hong Kong for a job fair. And I think I mentioned this in previous episodes, but those who are interested in living abroad, you know, getting into these sister groups, they have them in like almost every country and city you can think of. But I was in a Sisters of Hong Kong group, and I kind of put out a signal that I was coming to Hong Kong and I was gonna be there, and could anybody advise me on a place to stay? And you quickly mobilized efforts, and really, and yeah, I think your friend was like away, so I was basically like house sitted for a few days, and I got to stay in Discovery Bay in Hong Kong near you. And that's how we met. So thank you. It was a divine day. I think, you know, you're quite a remarkable woman. So I'm happy that that you remain in my orbit to today. So my first question is, like, how are things going on the ground in Tanzania amidst this pandemic?
Well, I think we're really about to find out because Tanzania has opened their borders. And starting at the beginning of June. And so kind of what happened, to go back a little bit, is once the first known case of COVID-19 came to Tanzania, they quickly shut things down, but we never went into any type of lockdown or anything like that. So schools closed, that was primarily the big thing. And then I would say about a month ago, there were kind of constant reporting of numbers, and we were seeing it, you know, start to escalate and some deaths happening in both Zanzibar and mainland Tanzania. And then kind of quite suddenly the numbers stopped coming about a month ago. There was no more reporting of numbers. And then, so the president kind of came and said, he had never like stopped like churches. He said, basically it was kind of a prey on this type of situation. And so the churches and the mosque remained opened and everything. But he said that he had sent some samples in to be tested, and then they had, you know, fruit and an animal or something had come back testing positive for COVID-19. So they weren't giving numbers. They were going to do some more investigations. So to this day, we've never had any more numbers, although there was a report earlier this week that came back and said that in Dar es Salaam, at least where I am, there were only 4 active cases left. I do believe that the numbers have dropped because just kind of reports we're getting from our local clinics and things like that, or in Dar es Salaam at least, but we don't really have a true sense of what's happening. Most of the stores, people still have to, are wearing masks and things like that. But typically I would say 70% of the people who I see are not doing that now. And I'm thinking people kind of are acting like we're on the other side of it. Restaurants have opened, international flights are supposed to be starting back. I think Ethiopian Airlines and Turkish are the first to start going out this week, and then some others to follow.
So do you think that are the numbers skewed then? Because how is it possible? I saw this article about fruit and animals testing positive for COVID. So gosh, the numbers don't even seem like they're accurate. Only 4 cases.
Well, right now there are no numbers, so that's the problem, because there are no numbers. But Tanzania is so heavily reliant on tourism that they made a decision that they would rather save people in the economy, like as a long plan. So they stopped talking about numbers and decided that we're just going to roll out a plan of how we're going to create a safe space for people to come into the country. So people are supposed to be able to come in. What they said is everyone should be, there's no quarantine that's going to be required for Tanzania at all. But people are supposed to be having some type of test before they arrive here. So we'll see how this all kind of plays out. We're in the first few days of this rollout. So people can, they want to make sure people are able to come go to the beach, go on safari, all the tourist things that sustain Tanzania, that people are able to do that for the summer. So,
Well, it's interesting to see the different approaches like African nations are taking. Because like here in South Africa, it's being projected like it's not going to be international flights in and out of here until February is what's being projected. But that's interesting. So, I mean, obviously, with everything that's going on right now amidst this global pandemic, there are also raging protests across all 50 states and 18 countries. Just about the unjust killing of Black men and women. So how does it feel for you being away from home during times like this? And then also, how has your personal quality of life changed for you, and especially your Black son being outside of the divided state?
Well, let me say that's the probably for me and my family, the most traumatic thing was my son, who is on the autism spectrum, is in college in the United States in his second year. And he just spent the second year at a community college that has dorms. And so he went home for spring break and he went to my parents' house in Maryland for a week. And then partway when that week happened, then he got a note like, stay another week. And so he stayed another week and then they shut down. So right now he is still in the US. And then I was scared to try to bring him to Tanzania because borders were shutting every day and I didn't want him to get stuck in some place and not be able to move. And I didn't know if he could navigate that. Even though he has some experience with traveling, we're very, very cautious and we have to go, we go through everyone. He needs to know what's happening next. So he stayed put, and by the time we could figure out there was some place, a flight that he could take, the border shut. So he wasn't able to come. He started saying, Tanzania started implementing, people had to go to dorms basically for a couple of weeks. So I wasn't going to do that to him. So anyway, so I've been away from my son and I've been worried about him.
Especially being at home right now.
So I'm waiting for this to open back up so I can get back to him. So, I can talk to him. And luckily he was with my parents, but probably I would say in the way that shaped my perspective on this is, in the past couple weeks or month, I've been really deciding that I need to get a place in the U.S. I need to have some type of home base or something, to that effect. It having a 20-year-old, especially the reason I mentioned the autism spectrum is because it affects so much of how we proceed. But honestly, the thing that I was the most scared about happening to him in the U.S. actually happened to him in China a few years ago. So, yeah, so we were living in Beijing. I think it was the week after he graduated. It's probably almost 2 years, 2 years to the day, probably very close to the today. He was out the day before he was actually leaving Beijing. He was out and disappeared straight off the street. Yeah, so about
11, oh my goodness,
walking around looking for my child who takes his evening walk. And people, a couple of my coworkers had actually warned me, like, to not have him out at night because they saw the police actively dealing with Black men out there, African men primarily, that were on the street. So I told him, don't be out after dark. So he had not. He had gone and taken his walk, and apparently he had been next to our building. I find this out later, you know, about 1 o'clock in the morning when I figure out what happened, that he had been just jumped on by some undercover officer.
What?
Innocent person he is. Now let me go back and explain. So my son, you know him, you've seen him, but he's about 6'3", but he's just the most, you know, innocent, you know, person. So he says to me, like, mom, like, that they jumped on me, and they're yelling at him in Chinese, you know, in Mandarin. So they jumped on him. He said he thought it was a kidnapping, you know. So he's screaming, help me. And, you know, so they jump on him, they handcuff him, you know, they put him in, he says, another guy from Nigeria, and he's just gone. So I've gone by, you know, by midnight. He's a very routine person who has follows a routine. So when he had not come back in, I'm getting help, you know, from people like my coworkers, and we're walking along the streets. I lived in downtown, right downtown in Beijing. The police, like, I'm giving them all the information. We're walking around. They're asking me, is he in bars? And I'm like, no, you know. So I'm in a bar at 1 o'clock in the morning looking for him. And he's able to call me back and tell me where he is. And luckily I was with the police, because only these people would only speak to the police. So I was, and they had identification and all these things. So anyway, when I got finally at 3 o'clock in the morning, they said, well, if he checks out, we'll bring him back. So they drug tested him. They checked his papers, all these things. And then at 3 o'clock in the morning, they like bring him back, and they're like, I'm standing outside this police station shaking, you know, I'm so upset. And they bring him, they were like, okay. They were like, is this your mother? You know, is this your son? We're going to say, like, he tested, you know, it was all fine, but word is like, don't do drugs. And I was like, nobody does drugs. You know, like,
my goodness.
Like, mom, please just let's go home. You know, let's let this die, you know, ride here. So anyway, he, like I said, his clothes were torn up. He was very embarrassed.
Oh my God.
Sidewalk. They had hit him with batons. They had put his clothes over his face, you know, so all these things. And they had kept him. When I was calling him over and over, he was sitting like in a, you know, a cell or something, waiting with seeing and hearing his phone ring and not being able to answer it. And so all those things that I've kind of never wanted for my child, you know, like, of course nobody wants it, but, you know, have tried to actively keep him away from, actually happened. So I watch this now with, like, okay. I mean, he was alive, but he was damaged, you know, like, he was damaged. And I need to, like, kind of to acknowledge that that's what these type of things do to these, do to our boys, particularly. Yeah, so he's there.
That's crazy, because, I mean, usually, you know, moving abroad gives you some modicum of security, even if it's psychological, that you and your loved ones will be safe, that you don't have to deal with, you know, some of the racism that we contend with in the United States. But China is notoriously racist. Mm-hmm. I'm really sorry your child experienced that.
I was gonna say, only for him, we were leaving the next day and he wasn't coming back, but we were leaving for Hawaii for his, like, vacation, his graduation kind of gift. And so the next day, to kind of be sitting in Hawaii, that kind of, it soothed a lot of the pain. And we had also gone, and he talked, you know, my school, I was at a very good international school in Beijing. And so we had, you know, liaisons. So the next day people were able to come like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this, you know, and let's act on it. And I'm sure someone got in trouble because of the situation of who they roughed up. But, you know, it's kind of the same situation that could, you know, happen at home. But yeah, it was definitely profiling, and they just decided that they were going to catch him. Apparently sometimes during the year, there's certain periods of time, and that he, I didn't realize this, but that was the period of time where they do sweeps of people on the street, certain people. But also it made me leave China. So the next year when it's time to sign, even though the school was kind of known as being in, you know, the top tier of international schools, I decided that that was not worth it because I would never bring him back there again. And so I'm like, I can't be living someplace where I cannot bring my child and, you know, and him be comfortable. So here we are in Tanzania without that issue.
Wow. It's interesting that you mentioned how, like, the school kind of mobilized their efforts just to ensure that, like, the police officers were punished in some way. And we'll get into that later, but the caliber of if you are an educator or a professional that's looking to work abroad, the caliber of the institution that you are working for is clutch. It can make your life much easier or much harder, but we'll get into that a bit later. So I mentioned in your bio that you're originally from the DMV area and you spent years as an attorney before making the career pivot to become an educator. What was the impetus for this and your subsequent decision to move abroad?
Okay, so for me, I worked for Legal Aid for 13 years in Maryland. And then kind of in a, I think maybe it's a couple of things kind of came together. I had been recently divorced. And so I was raising like my two kids and running out of courtrooms. Like, well, putting them down inside our courtroom office and things like my son inside the office and things like that. And then my mother was a special education teacher for part of her career. She stayed home with us, but she had gone back after we had graduated. And one day she mentioned to me, like, maybe you want to do this, you know, you could spend more time with, you know, you have schedules more in line with the kids. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, why would I do that? I'm a lawyer, you know? And then I was in a networking group, matter of fact, and it was like a bunch, it was all Nigerian women, almost, I think, me and a Ghanaian woman. And somebody put out in this group something about a resident teacher program. And I was like, wow, I love literature. And maybe I want to do something, you know, different. So I rushed and I took a praxis exam, and the program that I looked at, I didn't get into, but I got into what's called a resident teacher program. So they take people who already have a degree, and then you do your teacher training kind of on the job. So, and they put you in kind of low income area schools, mostly like Title I schools, and you learn. And so they were just starting a program the year I started doing it. I'm from Prince George's County in Maryland, and so it was Prince George's County program. And they were starting one that was a joint something with special education. So once, you know, I said I would do that. And then also at that point, my son had been diagnosed with autism, which is really why I wanted to spend kind of more time with him. Actually, I had a much more flexible schedule when it come down to it as an attorney than I ended up having as a teacher. Anyway, so it kind of all converged. And then the first year when I was teaching, the woman who was the head of the department ended up actually, I didn't realize at the time, but she had worked at the International School of Bangkok and started their special education program. And she was like encouraging, right? Who, like this Black woman, now I'm like, wow, she's like, you know, top tier. And she had raised her children by herself. And she's like, listen, I saved this much money. Kids did everything, all the lessons, music, dance, you know, and all these things. And then she, so she had really, you know, encouraged me to go on with that. And I had always had a passion, like, for travel. So I had had those experiences, and I really had tried to find some things abroad as an attorney, but that was really challenging for me. So the teaching I knew also gave me, like, so many more opportunities to go ahead and make that move. So after teaching, yeah, so that's kind of what led to it. And I never really meant to leave law I meant to do it for, like, 4 or 5 years and then go back. And now I'm in my 10th year. So I'm starting to think about how to meld my career paths together. When I was in law school, I did some legal work. Well, I did some summer legal programs in Nairobi at the Faculty of Law. And then for my last year, I did an externship in South Africa, a legal externship in South Africa. So those things really kind of fueled my desire for travel and to live kind of this life abroad. But I knew that teaching was going to afford me that opportunity probably in a larger scale, because that was when I was looking for legal jobs abroad, it was, there weren't that many that I saw that were available. So teaching was another way to kind of get into that life. And it worked out the way that I thought it would, but the legal part was where kind of my desire to go abroad happened.
Wow. Okay. So basically you're having the externship in law school was sort of your first foray into like living abroad and professionally working abroad.
Right. So yeah, I did two summers in Nairobi in school, but we had a lot of opportunities to travel and just to get to know people and to be on campus, and that really living a student kind of centered life gave me a different view. And it's funny that I was thinking about my daughter right now, and I was like, she has not had any type of experiences like I had as a student. She lives very much a life of kind of luxury, but like we were taking local transportation and the classrooms. And so I felt it was, well, I guess each of our experiences authentic, but it felt very like we were living
privileged.
Your
daughter has a more privileged experience. And we'll actually get into that because I do want to delve into like raising third culture kids and raising children as a single mother overseas and some of the advantages and the privileges that come with that once you look. Because I think when I came to visit you, you had your live-in nanny and, so we'll get into that. So, you kind of mentioned your first foray into international living and moving to China. After you left China, you went to Hong Kong, correct?
The other way. So I was in Hong Kong first.
Oh, okay.
We were in Discovery Bay for 3 years. And then I went back home, actually, for 2 years after that. I didn't mean to go. So I left Hong Kong. We actually traveled for a while around Southeast Asia, which was really cool. So we took time and we went to Thailand and Cambodia and spent some time in Bali and where else? Singapore. Yeah, so
That's one of the amazing things about being an international educator specifically is the amount of time that we get off, number one. The remuneration packages can be great. A lot of times the salaries are tax-free, and then it gives you the ability to travel. Who knows what's going to happen post-pandemic, but travel is very affordable once you leave the United States. So this leads me to my next question, because there are a lot of educators in the United States who are unaware of the earning potential and lifestyle upgrades that are available to them as a result of choosing a career in international education. You've now taught at 3 international schools. What can you say about the differences between being an educator in the divided states and working abroad?
I don't even think they're comparable, and I actually feel bad for people a lot of times. And I'm like, I try to tell as many people as I can about what these things are, and I feel like they're reserved for kind of the chosen few. And we need to let people know that there's this life out here. I think about what happens like in the U.S. coming from the D.C. area. There's just a range of things to me that make living abroad, or the packages. Let's talk about the packages. And I'll try to be, you can ask me specific questions, because I try to be as upfront as I can in terms of packages and all of that. So one thing, and I hate to lead with it, but kind of just being treated in a certain way by students and by administration, I just feel like you're treated like more of a kind of a professional. plus you don't have kids cursing you out and stuff like that on the regular.
I'm glad you pointed that out. I know for me, when I made the transition to not living abroad, but working as an educator abroad, I had quite a moral dilemma because I mean, obviously my passion as an educator are for Black students, period. And I worked in the education, Philadelphia education system, and also in the South. And I cried. I cried before I left. I almost felt like, you know, gosh, am I giving up on these kids? But, you know, at the same time, my grandmother used to tell me self-preservation is the first law. And, like, I was not going to contend with being disrespected and underpaid at the same time anymore. And, like, one of the things that you pointed out is, like, we already spoke about, like, the remuneration packages are totally not comparable. But also the level of respect that you receive for your profession as a teacher, as an educator, from students and, like, sometimes, like, the country that I've lived in, they just have more respect for educators. Have you encountered, for me, I know my last assignment, I encountered quite a bit of white supremacy in the workplace, and I wasn't entirely expecting that, because most of the education systems that I worked in, I mean, Philadelphia was very Black. Obviously, white supremacy does not function in a vacuum. I understand that, but I certainly didn't expect to move 13,000 kilometers away from home and be inundated with white administrators that had the same intentions for, you know, these children of color overseas that they had at home. Have you had any experiences like that that were challenging for you adjusting as a professional overseas?
Oh, yes. I mean, I feel like we get hit with it kind of everywhere. But this is one of the reasons, too, though, I feel like I'm fine teaching abroad is because we're everywhere, too. Like, we have students everywhere that need to be protected from some of this or to see us or to have someone fight for them. You know, like, I have, even here in Africa, you know, like, it's in the same systems that have been put into place to protect people's privilege and to protect, you know, what they have. And, you know, like, you have to look at this, and I'm thinking to myself, no, like, I have these kids here, and I got to keep an eye out for them and make sure that you're not trying to say they don't need to do the full IB program or whatever it is. But even on work, we face so many, and I don't even know if I want to call them microaggressions. Some as teachers, you might, you know, the bottom of just macroaggressions just out there in your face. But
right.
Sometimes when I look at the people who are in the higher, I think, international schools or the desire, you see, I feel like the people that you'll see, the Black folk are definitely a more qualified, you know, it's a more qualified, we have to have more still. You know, to this day, I think a lot of people will interview me because I'm a lawyer, but that's not what you expect for most teachers.
So, right.
And I think generally, you know, across the, like, I see that. And so I think we struggle in these same systems that are other places. And it's not just the US, but people bring those same systems from Australia. They bring them from the UK. They bring them, you know.
Canada. Yeah. That's one of the things that the, I mean, obviously there are Black administrators that are involved in international education.
Not many. Like going to all
that,
and I could like tell you, I'm like, and especially at the top schools, I'm like, there's that one brother from ISKL who's probably retired by now, and you know, like they're almost none, and there's like there'll be a woman, like one woman here. I'm talking about like Black people, not. There are more women coming, I think, into that arena, but and the Middle East may have a couple more, but by and large, that's really not a thing.
No, it's still a good old boys network. It is still a good old boys network.
All the things that we've been great about international, we didn't even get to all this. So to me, this opportunity to travel, whether it be like for trip, like with sports trips with the kids, or what I do MUN, so going on MUN trips with them.
Oh, I love it. Model United Nations for those that might be unfamiliar.
Oh, sorry about that. Yes. So that or training. So let's say at my school now, you have $1,500 that you can put towards whatever training you want. And you could save it up to 3 years. So from here, if you wanted to go do a training in Europe, I did mine actually in Cape Town this Christmas. I picked a place that a training that I wanted to do. So those type of things are not experiences that I would have had. So I've in the US. So professional development, my insurance is paid, which is huge. Like in where I am now, I was actually where the healthcare is kind of known to not be the best in Tanzania, but we have a clinic on campus that's probably among the best in the country. And you can just walk in and tell them what you need, like what's happening, and they'll treat you right then and give you medicine from the clinic right there. And then you can go about your business like at lunchtime, which is amazing. So what I was worried about has actually turned into be one of the more positive experiences in terms of general healthcare. Now, if you have something more serious, we didn't have in our contract that we would be flown out to either Kenya or South Africa, which is funny now in the midst of this pandemic, those borders were closed to us. So I was like, what happens now?
Right?
I did not get sick. So I have not been playing around with this. I've been in my house, except for my weekly trip to the grocery store. But so I'm not going to get, my goal is to really not get sick here. But let me try to think what other things. So the respect level, small classes as a special education teacher, we don't have like long IEPs. We pretty much, in every place I've been, we've kind of created our own thing that we do. And it's usually definitely not more than 2 pages. Not the long things. And as a lawyer, I used to do a lot of special education cases. And so I would be enforcing these documents, and as a special education teacher in the U.S., I would be making sure that, okay, I sent this 14 days before this meeting, things like that, but these are not issues. So I'm really feeling like I get to deal with just student issues, like what is going on with the student and how are they learning and what can I do to improve that? And not that I don't think that we need some type of protections, because I do, but without having so many legal requirements, it gives me as a teacher a chance to work with students in other ways.
Right. I'm glad you pointed out like some of the pros. I mean, obviously no place, no country, no profession is a utopia, but I know for me as a professional, and I'm sure you could say the same thing, which is why you're on your third country. The pros definitely outweigh the cons. I don't even think we got into housing allowances and transportation allowances. Oftentimes, most of the times, if you're at a top tier school, even when you're not at a top tier school, usually your housing allowance is incorporated into your remuneration package. And I'll leave this in the show notes, but for any educators that are listening, Search Associates and what does ISS stand for? International School, or the recruiting platforms that educators use to secure these positions overseas.
Yeah. I was going to tell you briefly about the housing. So the housing allowances, I will say, so in Hong Kong, they gave us like the equivalent of $1,000, which was really not enough to cover the whole thing. So the issue with Hong Kong is housing is really expensive. So I ended up putting money on top of what my housing allowance was, but I think our salaries were also a little higher. So that's how it worked. But in the end, that's really the reason I moved on from Hong Kong. If I had been in a couple, like with another person, there were two salaries, I could have swung it. But one person and adding on to the housing and having a boy and a girl and having a live-in helper that I needed a room for.
Oh, you need 3 rooms. And you need a room for a nanny.
Yes. Right. So that was difficult there. And then in Beijing, they gave us a certain amount. And so I would say it was probably like the equivalent of like $3,000. And you could just get whatever. If you went under, then you got that money back. So they had it just determined based on your family size how much you got. And so I had that. And I got something that was probably right up under my budget. That was allotted. I think they had someone in the housing office who worked with you, and I think they probably told landlords exactly kind of what our allowance was. That's what we surmised anyway, a lot of us. But and then in where I am now, we have housing allocated properties So we don't get any money, but we have a nice apartment in an area that's close to the school.
Yeah, but the main point is that your housing is usually covered in large part are in full. For me, my last assignment when I was in Qatar, it was predicated on family size and, you know, being there as a single person. I took the housing allowance as opposed to living in employee appointed villas, which were really nice. But even as a single person, my housing allowance was like almost $2,400 a month. So it depends on the package. It depends on the location. And again, I'll leave information in the liner notes. Yeah, if you're looking for a job overseas, and I don't care if you're an educator or architect or whatever, if you're being recruited to work overseas, your housing should be incorporated into your package. Just know that. So you mentioned your son and your daughter. So you have two third culture kids. What has it been like for your kids to adjust to living overseas? I should probably qualify what third culture kids are. It's like kids that are raised in different countries, but you know their parental origins are in other countries. So for instance, I think your kids are Kenyan and African American, but have lived in Beijing. They've lived in Tanzania. They've lived in Hong Kong. What has the experience been like for your kids adjusting, living overseas?
Overall, it's been great. They've been exposed to so many different things and so many different people, and they're really flexible kids. And you know, in that regard, you know, I kind of watch my daughter in amazement, and she kind of jumps into the culture. Like I always have to come to her because she lets me know about things that are happening here. So say like we're in Tanzania now. So she knows more about like the actual culture and games that people play and sayings that they say. Or like she'd be sitting here watching something and I'm like, did you just say that in Chinese? And she's like, yeah, you know, or whatever, you know. So at that age, they're coming at young ages, you know, elementary school and all that, they're sponges. So she's now, I think, too, with technology, she's talking to her different friends around the world. We said this past weekend, we watched her friends graduate in Beijing. We watched people in Tanzania and Zoom. You know, she talked to her friends in Hong Kong and the ones that in the U.S. because people are doing like drive-bys and all that. So it's nice. Sometimes I wish I hadn't maybe moved them around as much. Because I mean, people I think need to put down some roots at some time, you know, but I think that what they benefited from the situation has been positive overall. I will say that schooling for my son was definitely more challenging because of the things I said earlier. I think that were helpful to me as a teacher. Maybe those were helpful to him. People could do more things with him. So, but he is definitely like not your typical profile of a student that you would find in international schools here. He was always in the special education classes at home, which, you know, are largely designed for that. But you come to international school and they're like, what, you know, that's not the life that we're about really. And so some of those things were challenging, I think, for him. But overall, I think for both of them, the experiences have been great.
Yeah, I mean, you really are raising global citizens like, in the realest way. So there are some mothers in our audience who may feel a bit troubled about taking the leap, especially with their children. What advice can you share about your transition overseas, especially as a single mother, for aspiring Black women who are expats with children?
I say do it. That's my advice. Whenever I hear people say, oh, I want to do this, like when my kids finish school, I'm like, no, the time for you to do this is when your kids are in school. There are just so many, to me, like, to benefits. Like, so as a single parent, having the ability to afford someone else to come in the house to help me, release me to be a better parent overall. The fact that I was able to go out, or I didn't have to spend all my time trying to keep a house or keep that, you know, like those things are actually what made me, like, I think, a better parent to my kids at that point in my life. And just kind of meeting like-minded people. Of course, the travel aspects of it with them and without them. So, and for international teaching, and probably most positions, a lot of positions that you'll get, there'll be some type of subsidy for your kids to go to school. And so my kids have gotten, you know, educations that I would not have been able to afford on my lawyer's salary even. And so, you know, like the school in Beijing, that tuition was like $50,000 and they included all these things in it. But we had the benefit of that the same way as anyone else. And they're treated, I've never seen a situation where the kids, this teacher's kids are treated any differently than the kids who are paying full tuition or anything like that.
So, right.
It's an awesome opportunity to take when they're of a certain age and they just have a lot to learn and they can soak it up.
I didn't get to ask you all the questions about that because like I feel like outside of the United States, nannies are so affordable. It's so affordable. I know for like in Qatar, you know, some of my friends that had live-ins, they were paying, they're paying about $600 a month. And that's generous by Middle Eastern standards because, you know, the locals actually pay less than that. So they're actually pretty happy when they're dealing with Westerners because they're remunerated a bit better. Could you give like figures, like how much does a live-in nanny cost in a place like Hong Kong or Beijing or Tanzania?
So I would say Hong Kong, it was about $700 and it was very regulated in Hong Kong. So there's a salary that
cheaper than daycare. Much.
Definitely cheaper than daycare, like everything, you know, so they had that unlocked. And in Hong Kong, it was primarily, so either the women from the Philippines or Indonesia, and those are the groups that were allowed in. There were like three groups of people that were allowed to have the visas to do those tasks. So again, a lot of people still manage to not treat them the way they should, but it was about between $600 and $700. And in Hong Kong, it's they have to be live-in, but some people don't, but that's the law. So in Beijing, I did not utilize those services by that, but we had someone to come in to help clean a couple times a week. And I would say that may have been like, you know, $100 to $200 a month for a lot of time spent in some cooking and things like that. Here in Tanzania, the wages are really low. So I would say about $200 a month.
For a live-in?
Live-in, I was just looking at wages. If somebody lives in your house, it's even cheaper. I do have someone who lives
in Egypt. You're lying to me. That sounds like bondage and servitude.
And that's like, that's not even with the minimum wages. This is like, this is expat money, what I'm talking about. Like,
what? I would feel some kind of way, even if that is like the standard. I would personally feel some kind of way about paying somebody $100 to $200 a month to take care of the most precious things to me, which are my children.
So somebody to help take care of the kids, and they might have somebody, another person to cook or something like that. So like for here, I employ someone who comes in, he just left, matter of fact. He comes in on Friday morning and he makes me like 4 or 5 dishes, and that's $13. I buy the food, but he's a chef. So he makes everything from enchiladas, and he makes homemade tortillas. Maybe some chicken tikka masala and chapatis, which are for people who've been in West Africa, like, you know, like the like flatbread based, I guess, from the Indian dishes. But yeah, so whatever I kind of.
Your chef has a nice palate.
I come up with this, and you know that he's like, yeah. Or like, Kate, you know, like, okay, can you make some brownies? They're not exactly what I would have made sometimes, but a lot of things we get, I'm like, oh, this is really good. But again, like the cost of that is, again, $13, about $13 a week is what I pay. And then I have my meals and it stops me from going out so much too.
Yeah, it's affordable. It's so affordable to outsource, you know, tasks that free up your life when you don't live in the United States. Thank you for that. Thank you for being forthcoming about numbers. So what's the biggest lesson that you've learned about stepping outside of your comfort zone?
Stepping outside my comfort zone, let's see. I think going outside of what can traditionally be like a bubble where you live, if you like, say someone like me who's coming, I have a job, and it could be easy for me not to leave, like, you know, be a 5-mile distance from my house, kind of just meet other people and go outside to places that I haven't been before. I think it's more challenging when you don't have a command of a language. And I think stepping outside without the language is probably the most uncomfortable thing that I think I've experienced in all of these places, and in varying degrees. But I don't know, reaching out to more local people and doing things like that. And that, I think that pushes me at least, and makes me learn new things and have more respect for wherever I am.
Yeah, I think language immersion is really important. Career, for instance, I didn't even bother immersing myself in the language, and I was probably remiss in doing that. I only learned just key things, pleasantries, knowing how to get home, that kind of thing. But yeah. Language immersion makes your life a lot easier, and it's a sign of respect to the culture. Yeah,
I would say but that's it. But and also, it's funny because my daughter, you mentioned earlier, my ex-husband is from Kenya, and they speak Swahili, but they're different versions. So Tanzania is supposed to be like the pure Swahili here. So we're learning this, but my daughter gets a little bit of flack. One, because now it's made it easier for us to go to Kenya. So we've been to Kenya and visited her family there, frequently since we've moved here. But when she comes through, at first they were just like, oh, I wouldn't know you were Kenyan except for your passport. So she didn't like that at all. And, so there's like kind of this little also rivalry between Kenya and Tanzania. So she's tried to get her language skills.
That's pretty cool, though, that your kids are like so close to their second home country now.
It's really cool. I love it. This made me really happy to be able just to, even on a layover, to be like, all right, we're coming through Nairobi. We went to Rwanda a couple months right before.
Oh, I love Rwanda.
Yeah, it's awesome. So we stopped.
Kigali is popping. People don't. And Kagame is, I think he's the best. President on the continent, personally.
Yeah, I was saying it's like they realized they had gone so far left, with the genocide. It's like they try to come all the way, like, let's just get it all together, come all the way.
Right. Kagame's a great leader.
So we really liked it there. But the idea that we could just jump off in our layover and be like, all right, we're going to come have dinner.
You've basically been immersed in like Asian countries. How has it been adjusting to Africa?
It's been fine because we always had Africa as part of what we've done. Even when I was divorced, I would take the kids to Kenya the three of us would just come and visit. So this hasn't been shocking for them because they were already, and when actually I was telling you earlier that I had taken some time after I lived in Hong Kong, and we traveled Southeast Asia, and then we actually went to Kenya. We were thinking about moving, and so we came to Kenya and stayed for half a year there. So they're familiar with East Africa from that. So it hasn't been such a huge transition.
I think kids adjust to adults sometimes. So my last question is, what is next for you, and where can people keep up with your journey on social media?
I do not know what's next. I like it here. So hopefully you can find me right here, IST and Dar es Salaam. Anyone's free to look me up. I'm on Facebook, and I just got Instagram, so I can listen to DJ Nights. But other than that, I need to come up with
if he could listen to DJ Dice.
I was like, all right, I was getting mad seeing people post up. I was like, I gotta be in this party. So the first night I joined Instagram. So yeah, _Olili, O-L-I-L-I. So my father was a history teacher, and he had a friend from Nigeria, and he gave me her name, Olili. And I was actually supposed to go to Lagos next week for the first time, and I was hoping to meet her because I know that's where she is, and I'm still friends with like some of the younger generation of that family. So I guess we're not younger generation anymore, but so yeah, that's been put off, but I'm sad about that. But again, it was nice to be able to get a $350 flight to Nigeria from here. So, round trip.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, no, that's like, man, travel is just exponentially decreased. The amount of money you spend on travel outside of the United States is stupid.
I wouldn't be able to do it. That's the thing, you know.
Yeah, it's like they deliberately create a barrier to entry to travel. Thank you so much for your time.
Shout out to our Patreon members for your support. If you too are interested in joining the Black Broads Abroad movement, you can follow us on social media, and that's BlackBroads. That's on Instagram and Facebook. And if you'd like to become a supporter on Patreon, you can do so on patreon.com/BlackBroadsAbroad.